I'm Tess Vaglund. You survived the holidays. Now it's time to reflect on 2008. Like, how did some of those early predictions turn out?
The American people can remain confident in the soundness and the resilience of our financial system.
Yeah. Also this week, author Margaret Atwood uses classic literature to size up our current cycle of debt and credit.
When credit dries up completely, you have a Scrooge situation in which Scrooge has a lot of money, but he does nothing with it. He just sits on it.
We'll hear more insights from her recent book, Payback. And you want to find a Scrooge? How about an economist's cold, rational look at gift giving?
I would come to dinner and tell you, Tom, thanks for inviting me. I was going to spend $50 on a bottle of wine. Here is the cash instead.
That story and more coming up as we continue our coverage of fallout from the financial crisis on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. It's official. 2008 was an annus horribilis for the U.S. financial system. Let us count the ways our economy let us down. Or did we let it down? Either way, it's goodbye and good riddance. I'm Tess Vaglund. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
I suppose the easy way to end this year would be to throw tomatoes at the New York Stock Exchange, maybe lob a few choice epithets at the mortgage brokers, real estate agents, banks, investment houses, regulators, borrowers, and lenders who helped get us into the housing mess, which you may remember is at the root of it all. But here at Marketplace Money, we've decided it's time to turn the other cheek and just look at the lessons we can glean from an historic financial cataclysm. Who better to help us do that than Marketplace's senior business correspondent, Bob Moon? Hello, Bob.
Hey, Tess. I get the feeling you didn't care much for 2008.
No. Looking at my 401k balance, I did not.
Uh-huh.
But let's go ahead and talk about some of the lessons learned here. What do you think? What should we take away?
Okay, lesson number one, don't trust economic forecasts.
Nobody knows what they're talking
about. Yeah, let me take you back to the start of the year. Here's President Bush issuing his yearly report on the state of the economy.
This report indicates that our economy is structurally sound for the long term, and that we're dealing with uncertainties in the short term.
Yeah, you know, that almost became the administration's mantra for a while, didn't it? Our economic foundations are sound.
Yeah, and he kept avoiding the dreaded R word, recession.
This is obviously a difficult time for the economy. You know, I like to say it's a rough patch.
And then he reassured us that those stimulus checks that went out in the spring would have the economy growing again by the end of the year. Well, that's where the president learned a lesson. Economic jumpstarts seldom achieve lasting effect. So by the end of the year, he was leaving it to his press secretary, Dana Perino, to face questions about whether the fundamentals are still sound.
We have a very mixed picture right now, and no doubt we're going through some challenging times, and it will just take us some time to work through it.
Yeah, and in fact, we know now that the recession started at least a year ago. So we learned rather painfully that the president's optimism did not come to pass, but he was not the only one who missed the mark this year.
Yeah, remember up until the start of the year, the Fed was still worried about inflation. Well, now suddenly experts are worried about a spiral of declining prices, deflation.
You know, I never thought I'd hear people worrying about gas prices being too low.
Seems like only yesterday we were fretting about oil maybe hitting $200 a barrel.
Yeah.
It got up to 147 in July, then 4 months later plunged back into the 40s. Same story for commodity prices. They went sky high, largely on the idea that in times of crisis, you put your money in real things, not paper.
Yeah, things like gold. Always a safe haven, right?
Well, those prices zigzagged so much that the problem was choosing the best time to buy into that market. It was a bit like maybe trying to find just the right moment to jump into traffic and run across the freeway outside our building here.
Oh, Bob, you know, that is a very good metaphor because I was feeling run down all year looking at my investments.
Yeah, a lot of us learned that there was just nowhere to hide, really. Even if you followed the golden rule of investing about keeping your eggs in multiple baskets.
Diversification.
Yeah, you could still lose. Treasuries were supposed to be safe, but at some point during the year, the returns on those sank so low. It was a lot like paying Uncle Sam to hold on to your money.
Yeah.
And back in September, we heard from one of our Marketplace Money listeners, Jerry from Baltimore. He gets the crazy idea of cashing out?
it just looks like the formula's changed. I'm heading for cash at a high speed.
Well, guess what? Some analysts figured out that wasn't such a bad idea with the returns that some mutual funds were getting. When you considered all the fees involved,
yep,
you'd actually come out ahead by putting your money under the mattress.
Oh, my goodness. Who knew it would come to that? Okay, but Bob, the exception to all this insecurity was the security of learning that, for example, the FDIC is going to make good if your bank fails, which we saw really come to fruition when IndyMac went under.
We have seen the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation covering billions of dollars in insured deposits. In fact, it's boosted the guarantee on deposits through the end of next year, at least, from $100,000 to $250,000 per depositor.
On the other hand, what was supposed to be a sure thing, the money market mutual fund, and not such a sure thing.
Yeah, supposedly you could always count on getting at least a dollar back for every dollar you invested in those. But
yep,
then investors started pulling their money out. And when one fund couldn't cash in its IOUs from Lehman Brothers after it went belly up, it broke the buck, as they say. That made a lot of us nervous. Since then, the government stepped in to kind of shore that up. But that brings us to the painful lesson that Henry Paulson learned. It's very risky to let a financial institution that's too big to fail go ahead and fail.
I never once considered that it was appropriate to put taxpayer money on the line in resolving Lehman Brothers.
Well, we know now that unleashed weeks and weeks of painful turmoil. That's really when we suffered through those huge stock market plunges, some of the worst since the Great Depression.
Well, you know, Bob, that's a phrase that we heard over and over again just the last few months. The worst since the Great Depression. Can we look back at this yet and say whether that is truly the case?
Well, let's say that we learned our lesson from the Great Depression to now. Things are really nowhere near as bad. Yes, the Dow has lost, but less than half of what it was worth at its peak last year. After its 1929 peak, it lost 85% of its value.
Whew.
We've had fewer than 500 banks shut their doors during the 1930s. Remember, 10,000 banks failed.
I think even in the savings and loan crisis, there were more banks that shut than now.
Mm-hmm. And at the moment, about 1 in 15 Americans are unemployed. Back during the Great Depression, almost 1 out of every 4, imagine that, was out of work. So maybe we should wrap up on these encouraging words that we've been hearing from President Bush through this year.
I understand there's short-term difficulty, but I want people to understand that in the long term, we're going to be just fine.
Oh, I feel better now, Bob.
Glad I could help, Tess.
Marketplace's Bob Moon. Thanks for all your help throughout the year.
Thanks, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. Marketplace Money is supported by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
It's time for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story, and with me once again is our own Chris Farrell. Hello again, Chris.
Hello again, Tess, and that's quite a list of unthinkables that actually happened.
I know. Isn't that just hard to believe? I mean, you think about, you know, the gas crisis, the food crisis. Those all seem like they must have been at least 5 years ago.
Oh, I know. And, you know, journalists get criticized for using the word crisis too easily, but it's the right word.
Yeah. Well, you know, before we kind of get to a look at this past year, you and I have some business to attend to.
All right.
It is our final Straight Story of 2008, and therefore it is a time to look back upon January 4th, a point at which you and I made some resolutions.
Yes.
Are you ready to check in on them?
I'm ready.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm ready to give myself a grade.
Okay, well, let's start with number one. You talked about how you wanted to do a little more traveling and to budget for said travel.
I did well. I'm going to give myself a B+, A- on this one. I visited family and friends, which was important to me. I followed through, but I planned ahead, so my costs were manageable.
Well done. Well, I would give you a B+.
All right. I'll take the B plus.
Okay. Well, my first resolution was that I said my husband and I have got to open IRA accounts, that, you know, we were putting money into our 401ks, but that we hadn't done anything outside our employer plans. Nah, I have to give myself an F. Did not do this. But I'll tell you why. Because instead, we decided to max out our employer-sponsored retirement plans.
Oh, then don't give yourself an F. The product doesn't matter. It's the intent in what you're doing. So you set aside more money for retirement.
Yes.
I'm going to give you an A. I'm going to absolutely give you an A because the product isn't what matters. You got an A there.
Yay. Oh, thank you, Chris. Okay, number two for you, it had something to do with charitable giving.
Yeah, I'm going to give myself a C on this. What I wanted to do, my goal, was when I sit down at the end of the month, beginning of the month, and pay the utility bill and all that kind of stuff, that I would also include my charitable giving. I didn't do it. What I have done is in December, I did a lot of research. I thought a lot about where did I want my charitable giving to go this year because of the recession and the downturn. I think I found a good organization. I've been giving money. Nevertheless, I didn't work it into my monthly financial life. It's still a December activity.
I don't know. I think we have to give you at the very least a B plus or A minus on that.
Okay, I'll take the B plus then.
All right, excellent.
And you, what's your second one?
Well, my second one was that my family was going to put together an inventory of our household, a video of the house and its contents, as well as photocopies of all of our important papers, and something called a go box, which is something you can take with you if you have to leave your home in an emergency. Well, we got part of it done. We did do a video of the house. We got photocopies done and sent them off to a relative so that they're in a safe place just in case the house burns down. But we did not put together our go box. So I think maybe I should get half credit for that.
Oh, more than half credit. You did the bulk of the work.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will get to next year's resolutions when we talk next year.
Okay. That sounds good.
In the meantime, just to close out the year, I'd like to get your thoughts on what is the biggest lesson we've learned out of this financial crisis, apocalypse, cataclysm, whatever you want to call it.
In a very practical sense, in the economy that we're going through, the time that we're going through, you know, you need to recognize that when it comes to your savings for retirement, for your savings for your kids' college education, these are things that you need to do, and you need to be conservative with your finances so that if an opportunity does come along at some point in time, you can take advantage of it. But when we hit a bad economy, it's not pleasant, it's not fun, but you're not at the financial precipice.
Excellent advice, and I want to thank you for being our voice of reason, our voice of calm throughout this entire year. It's been really great to be able to turn to you, Chris, all throughout 2008 as we dealt with this crazy, crazy time. So thanks, as always.
It's been great, Tess.
All right, enough of the love fest. We'll talk to you later in the show.
All right, we'll move on.
We'll talk to you later in the show with Getting Personal. Thanks.
Okay.
Remember $4 a gallon? Well, lots of that gas money you spent earlier this year went straight to the economy of Houston, Texas, and it's made for some changes around those parts.
So you've got both great mansions forming and longer lines at the Houston Food Bank.
The ups and downs of a boom town. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Winter in Alaska is in full... snow on the ground, parkas on the kids, and it is expensive to live there. Food, clothing, everything costs more because of the extra effort required to get it to consumers. To take the chill off, Alaskans don't pay sales or income tax. And every year, many residents get a check from the dividends of oil drilling. This year's check was double the usual amount. Happy holidays! Emily Schwing reports from Homer, Alaska.
It's what Alaskans call the PFD, or Permanent Fund Dividend. This year, qualifying residents received over $3,000 from the state of Alaska. The checks were cut in September, a month earlier than usual, because of a one-time $1,200 rebate to defray the rising cost of heating oil. Of course, the state's natural abundance of oil is why the dividend exists in the first place. Michael Burns is the CEO of the Permanent Fund Corporation.
Probably that's about $13.5 billion that have been deposited in the fund from oil royalties.
The fund started in the 1970s after Alaskans blamed the state for a misuse of $900 million from oil lease sales. But Burns says it would be a mistake to think of today's dividend as purely oil money. That's because the permanent fund has tripled in value due to the stock market.
It's much more important what happens on Wall Street than what actually happens on the North Slope.
Despite Wall Street's recent downturn, Burns estimates the fund is worth more than $30 billion. But before you turn green with envy, Gunnar Knapp provides a little perspective. He's an economics professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage.
I think a lot of Alaskans would say, hey, listen, you couldn't pay me enough for what it's like by the time you get to the 19th snowstorm of the year in March and the darkness and so on.
Knapp is a father of three. That means his family's PFD payment will exceed $16,000 this year.
It, in effect, becomes an increase in Alaskans' income, a 4 or 5% increase in their income, and it tends to go for bigger ticket things that people have trouble putting together.
Knapp and his wife plan to use the money to pay down credit cards and other debt. But what are other Alaskans buying with their PFD? I asked some shoppers outside a local drug and hardware store in Homer.
We're going to see if we can't get a 37-inch widescreen TV that we haven't had before.
Well, for fuel and basically to buy other things such as a new vehicle.
I bought an elliptical trainer and a tank full of propane.
Outside the store, only Bob Robinson said he wished the money would stop coming.
My problem with a handout is there something wrong, inherently wrong with government when they have to have handouts like this? Something is not working.
Alaska does have its fair share of problems with rural poverty and lagging infrastructure. Professor Knapp says that sparked a fierce debate about the best use of permanent fund money.
You know, my wife, who's a school teacher, says when the dividend checks come out, that's the week poor kids come to school with new shoes.
But critics say the money should go toward essential public projects. Knapp also says Alaskans shouldn't rely on this dividend as a long-term source of income.
And I think that the larger the dividend checks and the more people hear about them, then the more we're going to run into an argument from Congress. If you need it, you're rich, pay for it yourself.
And that could contradict the purpose of the PFD, which is to keep some of Alaska's oil profits out of the hands of state lawmakers. In Homer, Alaska, I'm Emily Schwing for Marketplace Money.
From one temperature extreme to another, remember way back, 6 months ago, when energy prices ballooned? Well, so did the oil city of Houston, Texas. And even though gas has come down from its stratospheric levels, the city still boasts low unemployment and is projecting steady job growth for years to come. But as Kate Archer Kent of Red River Radio tells us, an oil-rich economy isn't an automatic pipeline to prosperity.
Hundreds of wealthy Houstonians recently toured a multi-million-dollar show home in a development going up 35 minutes from downtown. When they're finished, these waterfront estates will be able to accommodate 70-foot yachts in their backyards. Developer David Goswick isn't fazed about selling luxury homes in a down economy. He says Houston is brimming with potential buyers.
The oil industry, oil executives, and cardiologists, plastic surgeons, researchers from the Texas Medical Center are really the primary audience.
On the other side of town, the food bank is trying to keep pace with the city's growing hunger pangs. Brian Green is CEO of the Houston Food Bank. When he drills down into U.S. Census data, he finds that 35,000 people will go hungry in Houston today. That's 3,000 more than 2 years ago.
Our poverty rate has actually been increasing. Because of all the opportunity, we have a very large migration flow here of people who have not been successful where they were.
Those people are meeting with mixed success in Houston. Some are finding work and contributing to the city's economy, and others are draining it, says Steven Kleinberg. He's a sociologist at Rice University. He's studied the city's ethnic makeup for 25 years. Kleinberg says Houston is a microcosm of America.
What is happening in Houston as in America is
a growing gap between rich and poor. Houston has the greatest medical complex on the face of this planet and the highest percentage of children without health insurance of any major city in the country. So you've got both great mansions forming and longer lines at the Houston Food Bank.
Brian Green does a lap of his massive food bank warehouse. He ducks into refrigeration rooms filled with everything from a botched order of bulk purple onions to stacks of bright green overstocked melons. Green says oil money is keeping his food bank topped up.
Houston is a fortunate place to be. If it wasn't for the increase in local donations, we would have gone down this year, like most food banks did.
Those donations come from a swelling population of high-wage professionals. The city will add more than 50,000 jobs this year, says Michelle Mitchell, the city's finance director. She says new arrivals who have jobs boost Houston's tax revenue. That allows the city to add services and lower property taxes.
It's an exciting time to be finance director. I mean, we have all of the oil companies here, so clearly we're the oil capital of the world. I mean, everyone in the world knows that. You know, go to Houston if you're going to talk oil.
But Mitchell says Houston isn't all about oil. One reason why it's getting ahead, she says, is because it diversified away from the oil and gas industry. Rice University's Kleinberg says it's a sharp contrast to the last Houston boom 40 years ago.
When the rest of you guys were having your stagflating 70s and your Carter malaise, Houston was booming because 82% of all the primary sector jobs were tied into the oil business. Houston is now much more diversified in its economy. It is locked into the national economy.
Waterfront home developer David Goswick hopes that Houston isn't too locked in. With the nationwide housing market still on its knees, he's hoping to sell homes that start at $1 million, which he says is pretty cheap.
Right now, in today's conditions, I don't know of anywhere in America where homes of this quality are being built on the water.
Fortunately for Goswick, Houston is still the oil capital of the world. Whatever happens to the wider economy, the city will continue to boom as global demand for oil continues to grow. Goswick expects as many as 10,000 people will tour his show homes when they're finished in the spring. In Houston, I'm Kate Archer-Kent for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. You can join the conversation at Gather.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we answer your questions. And with me once again is our personal finance expert, Chris Farrell. And Chris, you know, we get tons of emails with basic questions about how safe is my money during this turmoil in the banking industry. So we thought we'd take a few, and let's start with Patricia in Cincinnati. She wrote in and wondered, what happens to an IRA account when the bank it's with fails? How is it affected?
Well, it's not really affected much at all. She still has her IRA account. It's safe. She has the ownership. If the IRA money is in a savings account or money market deposit account, she has the FDIC insurance up to $250,000.
And then above that, no guarantee?
No guarantee. But that's a lot of money.
And in fact, if you are holding this much cash, then we wouldn't call you diversified, would we?
No, we would not at all.
Okay. Randall in Williamstown, Massachusetts, is wondering about what he calls kryptonite. It's an AIG policy that he is very tempted to cash in right now.
As an AIG policyholder, should I be getting out now? If too many of us take that view, aren't we just kicking AIG when it's down?
I wouldn't get out of AIG if I were a policyholder. You know, forget about whether you kick them when they're down, but is it a good move financially for you? And I would say no.
So should something happen to you and you are insured by AIG, you're going to get a payout?
You're going to get a payout. I think it would be a big mistake for people to panic over the AIG insurance company. If you're a stockholder of AIG itself, $170 billion of stock over the past year has vaporized. But that's a different story.
Okay. If you've got some questions, do let us help. Visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Robert wrote in from The Villages, Florida, and this isn't necessarily about bank accounts, but I think this whole situation has got people worried about all of their money, no matter where it is. And he's a little concerned about the safety of his IRA, even though it's being held by a private investment company, you know, the likes of Fidelity and TIAA CREF. Should he be thinking of spreading that money around over, you know, half a dozen firms to limit the risk if one of those fails? Again, we're not talking about banks here. We're talking about investment houses.
That's right. I mean, again, just to reiterate, the primary protection is that your money is in the market. That's no protection about the value of your money. So it's always a balancing act. You do want to have some diversification. You don't want to have so much diversification that it becomes difficult to manage your money. Most of us end up being fairly well diversified on our own if everything is with one institution, but it pays to shop around. It pays to be somewhat diversified, but I don't think it pays to slice and dice everything up too small, and then you're running around trying to keep on top of 8, 10, 12 institutions.
All right. Veronica wrote in from Loudonville, New York, and she says she has some Freddie notes in her IRA, and they're supposed to be providing her a nice little income. Are they now worthless?
No, they are not worthless. The notes of the debt are still valuable.
So these are bonds, basically.
These are bonds, right? And they have all different maturities. And what has the federal government said? In essence, we're guaranteeing this debt. Over a period of time, I think it's perfectly valid for people to ask questions, but there is no reason for anyone out there to panic. The federal government has put its full faith and credit behind it. Right or wrong, that's what they've done.
Okay. Chris, I'm just wondering if you might share with folks kind of what your strategy is right now. I mean, are you worried about the banking system at all? Have you pulled your money out anywhere? Have you decided to spread it around more than you would normally?
I'm not worried about the banking system overall. Now I'm just talking about as an individual. Since 1933, since the FDIC was formed, no one's lost a penny in an insured deposit. I see no reason for that to change. Secondly, I don't think it comes as any surprise to you, Tess, that I have a well-diversified portfolio, which is down.
I hope so.
It is way down, but it is a well-diversified portfolio. What is true is that I have been pursuing no real changes in my retirement portfolio, my long-term money. What I have been doing is building up more savings. So in a sense, I've adopted a strategy that intellectually I've always liked, which is to stay very risky in terms of the retirement, the long-term money, but in my personal life, my emergency savings, I've gone more conservative. I think people have to really move toward a world where they're paying more out of cash and less with their credit card, which is in the fancy way of saying build up your savings.
All right, Chris, let's get in one more email here. And Toshar wrote in from Raleigh, North Carolina, and wanted to know, can the common man buy shares in Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae because they're quite the discount right now? And is that a good idea?
Yes, it is possible. Very simple to do. They have a lot of shares outstanding. If it were me, as I remarked earlier on, U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson has made it very clear he's not interested in protecting the shareholders. So I think it's a lot more fun to go to Las Vegas, but be fully warned, you're making a bet that the current bailout is going to be enough.
Well, I guess enough is a relative term. That remains to be seen. If you have questions for us, don't hesitate to ask. Give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be back later in the show with more Getting Personal. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Let's face it, it has been a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad year, economy-wise. With every new day bringing a slice of new bad news, it's tempting to head to the beach and bury your head in the sand. Alternatively, you could go to a movie. And on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we'll meet someone who makes the silver screen magic happen.
My name is Derek Reed. I'm a projectionist here at the Cinémathèque Québécois, which is a film archive in Montreal, Canada. What you have here is a classic projection booth. You have two 35mm projectors, and as you can see here, it's a pretty classic-looking machine. It has big gears with a lens and a gate, which opens and closes where the image of the film is seen through. I actually got into this as a doorman. It was my job while I was a student. And I learned to project film as an apprentice. At the time I learned to project, there was a license, and you had to get an apprentice book, and you had to study under somebody for 500 hours. They've since eliminated all of that. And their argument was that because film's no longer flammable, anyone can do it. Basically, what you need to be a good projectionist is you need to be able to keep track of what's going on, because you have to be there when you need to be there. And if you're not there, then of course your error appears on the screen for everybody to see. Someone once told me that I'm the only sane projectionist they ever met, because long hours in the booth with lots of noise alone drives people crazy. The salary in this job, it's around $20 an hour, which isn't that much money. I watch my movies often in bits and pieces, because I'll be busy at the beginning of the film and then I'll go and watch the end of the film. So I can actually have a completely different impression of a film and then finally sit down and watch it and realize that it wasn't like it is at all. I often get asked how many movies I've seen. I had calculated that I had showed 10,000 movies in my first 10 years, but I've never gotten sick of movies. I still watch movies. I rent movies. I watch them at home. I still go to the movies. I just don't go to the movie theater that I work in, and I enjoy movies very much.
That was projectionist Derek Reed. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Judith Ritter. What do financial institutions have in common with Tinkerbell? Author Margaret Atwood says, like fairies, banks only exist if you believe.
If we stop believing they're safe, the bank actually vanishes, because nobody will do business with it or put money into it.
That and more fairy tales from her book Payback, coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Here's one bright spot in the personal finance headlines. The Federal Reserve tallies up our collective debt load each quarter, and for the July to September timeframe, we reduced our debt by almost a full percentage point. First time that's happened since they started keeping records more than 50 years ago. Yay, us! Credit has been a meta theme throughout this financial crazy time. Back in October, we talked to Margaret Atwood, the Booker Award-winning author and poet, about her new book, Payback, which looks at why we owe and who we pay. It's such an eye-opening take on our credit obsession that we decided to cap off 2008 with an extended version of that interview. Atwood says she began thinking and writing about debt 3 years ago, well before the current mess.
I came to it originally through literature. The 19th century novel, which I at one point studied, has a lot of money themes in it. It was the age in which capitalism was really expanding, and people didn't understand how it worked. Not that they do now, but you would have booms and busts, and people would lose their savings, and that got into literature. Also, from my own childhood, money was one of those things, the other two being sex and religion, that you were not supposed to discuss at the dinner table. And especially you were not supposed to discuss how much money anybody made. That was considered very rude. So everything that children are told not to discuss, of course, they become very curious about.
Well, I wonder, given all the literary references that you talk about in the book, where there is just this constant cycle throughout civilization of credit and debt, what do you think about predictions that this time we will learn? This time we will change our habits.
Cackle, cackle, cackle. Okay, first of all, the whole idea of debt and credit, you know, borrowing and lending, is based on a very fundamental human thing, and that is the sense of fairness.
Do you wonder at all if we've gone beyond the point of bothering to think about fairness?
The sad truth is that a lot of the hyper calculations that are going on in the financial world are not even done by people. They're done by computer programs. And when you remove the human element, you remove something that really, really needs to be there. A positive way of looking at debt and credit is it's a glue that holds society together. I lend to you, you lend to him, he lends to her, and out of those lendings, in the most positive scenario, something good can grow. Somebody starts a business, somebody buys a house. When credit dries up completely, you have a Scrooge situation in which Scrooge has a lot of money, but he does nothing with it. He just sits on it. And therefore, it accomplishes nothing in the world. It doesn't make anything happen.
You come back to Ebenezer Scrooge quite a bit in the book, and I wonder if you could share with us, I just love this, I did not know this, the origin of his last name.
Scrooge. Dickens was very fond of these names that call something to mind. So Scrooge is a portmanteau word that combines screw and gouge.
I think when you're talking about governments and even large corporations, I was very interested in your trickle-down theory of debt, which I think is what we're now experiencing and will probably experience for months and years to come.
We've heard about the trickle-down theory of wealth, and it's always interested me that they didn't say the gush down or the, you know, rushing torrent down. Unfortunately, the trickle-down theory of debt, in which if a big institution or debtor falls, a whole lot of little ones get crushed underneath. That is more than a trickle. It's more likely to be something like a piano falling on top of you. And that is why getting into a huge hunk of debt and then not paying it has a moral price tag attached to it, because it hurts other people.
And certainly that's where the notion of trust comes in again. I mean, if you had nothing to do with the financial system crumpling around you, how can you ever trust it again?
Well, even if you did have something to do with it, even if you put your life savings into a pension fund that then invested in some strange things, what are you going to do with your life savings? Is it put it in a sock under the mattress time again?
And what does history teach us the answer is?
History teaches us, I don't actually know, but I'll come up with something. History teaches us that we're going to go down until we hit the floor. And that floor is the moment at which people say, okay, it's not going down any further. We trust that it's not going down any further. So this is the floor, and it's called a floor because we can stand on it again. And then things can start being constructed from the ground up again.
I wonder if you would mind reading a couple of sentences for me from the beginning of the book where you pose a question that seems to have led you into writing the book itself. And then I'll ask you to answer that question. It's page 6.
Okay, here we go. I knew from fairy tales such as Peter Pan that if you ceased to believe in fairies, they would drop dead. If I stopped believing in banks, would they too expire? The adult view was that fairies were unreal and banks were real. But was that true?
And did you find an answer?
The answer is that money and banks and all of these kinds of institutions that we have built up, they're all human inventions. And therefore, they have a very large element of existing so long as we believe in them. Money is really just a sort of monopoly token, if you like. It's a symbolic thing. You can buy Park Avenue with it. But if you just keep it in your hand, it's not good for anything. You can't wear it, you can't eat it, you can't smoke it. It's just a token. Similarly with banks. Part of our belief in banks is that they're safe. If we stop believing they're safe, the bank actually vanishes because nobody will do business with it or put money into it. Wouldn't you say that's true?
I would.
Good. We agree.
Margaret Atwood, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
And let us hope we all regain some kind of faith and trust based on something solid pretty soon.
Margaret Atwood is the author, most recently, of Payback, Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
It's time for More Getting Personal, the part of the show where we answer your questions. And here again is Chris Farrell to give some advice. And Chris, we'll go right to Mark in Noblesville, Indiana. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
What do you do there in Noblesville?
I'm an optometrist, an eye doctor.
Oh, terrific. Well, hopefully we'll give you some 2020 advice here today. I'm sure you've
never heard that one before.
Right.
All right. Well, tell us what your question is for Chris today.
Well, my question is, it's kind of a two-part. I was considering Roth IRAs, especially custodial Roth IRA for my 16-year-old daughter as a college savings plan, as well as my little boy who doesn't have an income. But I thought instead of putting money, I guess, towards a 529 or a Coverdell, I wonder if I just put it in my Roth IRA, if he decides to not go to school or gets a scholarship or something, then I've got it for my retirement. You know, I didn't know if there's any pitfalls into that thinking.
Interesting. Well, Chris, we generally talk a lot about 529 plans as the best way to save for college. What do you think of this idea?
Okay, a couple of points. Let's focus for the moment on the 16-year-old daughter and thinking of the Roth IRA as a college savings plan. Mm-hmm. It's not a terrible idea. It's just not a great way for her to be saving for college. What it is a great thing to do is, I assume she's earning income, and so
she is.
You know, if you set up a Roth IRA for her and you just treat it as long-term savings, it's not going to hurt her in terms of financial aid, and then she can withdraw the earnings to pay for qualified educational expenses without paying the 10% penalty.
Mark, have you done any savings for her college yet?
Not much. And that's the thing, is because I'm a kind of a late bloomer. This is a second career. And so retirement had been on hold, and retirement actually has to come first. So, you know, what I understand, that should come first,
right,
before savings for college. You know?
And what about for the younger son?
Now, for the younger son, I use a different calculation. First of all, I liked what you said, Mark. Take care of yourself first. So absolutely, your retirement. For him, at this point in time, I don't think anything beats the 529 college savings plan, because you put the money in and then it's withdrawn tax-free and has minimal implications for the financial aid formula. So it is right now a very good college savings vehicle, plus aunts, relatives, they can all chip in. And so even sometimes now people are doing, they're saying, look, around the holiday season, you know, instead of buying a $25 gift, put the $25 into the 529. And it doesn't sound like that's much, but if you have a young son or a young daughter, it can add up over a period of time.
What if he decides to become a surf instructor instead and college is not in his plan? What happens to that 529 money?
Yeah, what does happen to the 529 money?
Well, then what you do is you transfer it to yourself or to, you know, somebody else in your family who decides they want to go on and continue their education. Or you could pay taxes and the 10% penalty on it. But usually what people do is they transfer it to another family member who is then going to use it. And by the way, there is no age restriction on a 529 plan.
So, Mark, you could use it for yourself and have a third career.
Exactly.
Either that or tell my wife that we got a plan on another kid as a backup plan, huh? For the 529.
I'll leave that between you two.
Yeah, yeah. All right.
All right. So does that help you out, Mark?
It sure does. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm, you bet. Bye.
All right, let's go to one more email. And Ariana writes in from Yukon, Oklahoma. She is a junior at an Oklahoma State University. She's taken out about $3,000 in loans each semester. Ouch.
Yeah.
But her mother has just informed her that she has about $2,000 in savings bonds.
Ah.
It's kind of like finding a $10 bill in your pocket. No, actually, it's not like that at all. It's $2,000.
It's like $2,000.
So her mother wants her to use the savings bonds instead of a loan for one of the semesters. But Ariana thinks she should use it to pay off interest on her existing loans. What do you think?
Well, I'm with Mom. I would not borrow for the semester that you don't need to. But let's go with an impartial observer. I'd go to the financial aid office and say, would you please run the numbers for me? Or you can call your student loan lender. They'll run the numbers for you. And then you can make an informed decision.
So they can basically help her figure out the math on how much interest she could save by paying off for one semester, or how much she could save by simply paying down some of the interest on the loan she already took out.
Exactly. It's easy for them to do. And in this sense, they're your friend. In other senses, maybe not. But in this sense, they're an ally.
Well, Chris, let me pose a question that Ariana didn't ask, but I'm curious. You know, she has this $2,000 now, and we're always talking mm-hmm. about saving for the future, that you've got to get a retirement plan going as soon as you possibly can. And you've talked about how student loan debt is actually good debt. So would there be any reason for her to take this $2,000 and, say, put it in a Roth instead of putting any of it toward the student loan debt?
You know, that's an intriguing question. I wouldn't put it necessarily for retirement, but what about this thought? She's a junior, right? You said she's a junior.
Right.
So she's going to be graduating soon. And when you graduate from college, there can be a lot of expenses at that time. Perhaps you're going to move to a different town, a different city to take a job, or you need a new wardrobe depending on the job that you're taking, or you know, you've gotten away with not having a car for the 4 years at college, but now you've got a real commute. So, you know, it's nice to have a pot of savings when you graduate to get you through these transitions into the employed work world.
All right. Thanks for the email, Ariana. Unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take for today, but we're answering your questions online all the time. Write to us with the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Thanks, Chris, as always, for the great advice. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Now that the major gift-giving portion of this holiday season has passed, you may find yourself surrounded by stuff. Nice stuff, but stuff you didn't necessarily want or need. Ever wonder why we do all this? Maybe it's bad manners not to? Well, commentator and economist Dan Ariely says in the rationality department, gifts come up short.
From a standard economic perspective, gifts are a waste of money. Imagine that you invite me over for dinner one day and I decide to spend $50 on a bottle of wine. There are a bunch of problems. To start, I'm not sure what wine you would like the most. And besides, maybe you'd prefer something else, like a book, a DVD, or a blender. This means that the bottle of wine that cost me $50 might be worth at most $25 to you. If gift-giving were rational, I would come to dinner and tell you, Tom, thanks for inviting me. I was going to spend $50 on a bottle of wine. But realizing that this might provide you with only $25 of benefit, here is the cash instead, and you can decide how best to spend it. Or even better, maybe I would split the cost and offer Tom $37.50, making both of us better off. But despite the realization that gifts are economically inefficient, I don't suspect that many people would follow this advice. Why? Because even though a cash gift is more economically efficient, it will in no way endear you to your host. For example, if the day after the dinner party you find yourself in a bind and need some help moving a sofa, the odds are that the host that you gave a gift to will step in to help. But what about the host that you gave the efficient cash gift to? Wouldn't his logical response be, "How much are you offering me for my time?" The point is that while gifts are financially inefficient, they are an important social lubricant. They help us make friends and create long-term relationships that can sustain us through the ups and downs of life. They are, in fact, efficient because they help us create the social fabric we so depend on. It turns out that sometimes a waste of money is worth a lot.
Dan Ariely is a professor of behavioral economics at MIT. His book is called Predictably Irrational. Send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, Chris and I reveal our financial resolutions for 2009. We'd love to hear yours. Go to marketplace.org and tell us your New Year's promises. Meanwhile, you can ponder this argument against offering your kids cash for good grades.
Reward programs, well-meaning though they might be, actually undermine the very things we're trying to promote.
Marketplace Money is produced by Jim Wallace, Stephen Hoffman, Eve Trope, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tessa Vigeland. A very happy new year to all of you. We'll see you in 2009.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
American Public Media.